is in session. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our House members today. I'm not sure what we have in front of us. I kind of need a schedule, I think. No, I'm just kidding. Execution is everything in morning jokes, and when it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So let's call up Josh and Mark for our revenue forecast.
Good morning, Senator Haas, members of the committee. My name is Mark McMullen. I'm the state economist with the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis, joined as always by my colleague Josh Lehner. The big one, the forecast every May of the odd year is the one that really does set the bar for our kicker law and our balanced budget requirement. So it gets a little bit more attention than we typically do. And this one will make a little bit of a splash insofar as there is a lot of new money in it. A significant amount of more available resources relative to what we put out last year, and in particular 3 months ago in March. But the trouble is we don't know if any of these additional resources are real yet. There's always uncertainty in terms of our forecast, but right now it's really at a premium. We're at a point in both the budget process and the business cycle where the uncertainty and the dependence on the forecast and the outlook are the strongest. As we move through the cycle, the reality gradually takes over and the forecast becomes less important. We start to get tracking, we start to get data on how revenues are actually coming in rather than how we expect them to. And so, you know, in particular right now, the current biennium, 13-15, it's really all about tracking and how the forecast, how the revenues are coming in, how April was. If we were to change our outlook, our trajectory for employment and jobs right now, there's not enough time left in the current biennium for it to really amount to much, to turn into anything. But there is certainly uncertainty still in the current biennium. In a typical year, this May forecast is off by $150 million. So there's still uncertainty, but it really doesn't have to do with our outlook for the economy, because there's really not enough time for these economic changes to compound. But the opposite is true when we look forward into 15-17 that the legislature is budgeting for now. That has everything to do with the forecast. And for that, if we make very small changes in the trajectory of employment or wages and the like, these things are going to compound over 2.5 years and very quickly turn into hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's really what we're seeing right now. We're looking at, we've gone to a very aggressive forecast that now injects this additional revenue, but it comes with quite a bit of downside risk involved insofar as these very small changes turn into very, very large revenue numbers. So to the extent, given there's so much uncertainty here and we have a whole 2 years ahead of us and no dollars in the door yet, to the extent that the legislature can try to keep the feeding frenzy of the next couple of weeks at bay and put away some of this either as an ending balance or reserve funds, I think that that's obviously prudent for the state right now, given the uncertainty that's involved here going forward. So in terms of the economic outlook and where we are, when I was here 3 months ago, I led off my talk by saying that these are the salad days for Oregon's economy. That across all indicators, things are looking good, and we're growing about as fast as we ever do. Well, that was 3 months ago. I think in the interim, we have started to see a few fault lines at the U.S. level in terms of for the first time in several months, we're starting to see. So not all universally good indicators. We're starting to see some numbers that are troubling. Still, the vast preponderance of estimators or indicators, that is, are still positive, and it doesn't look like and there aren't people out there calling for the wheels to fall off the recovery anytime soon or anything like that. But I think if we look back at this in 5 or 6 years, I feel pretty strongly, or my gut tells me that the end of 2014, beginning of 2015 will be about as good as it got. It doesn't mean things are over, but it'll probably be the top. It's kind of similar to what went on at the bottom. In 2009, we had the Fed chairman and a lot of economists start talking about green shoots. And they got laughed at because after they started talking about green shoots, we had a couple years and thousands of job losses that followed. But looking back at it, that was just about the time when they started talking about green shoots that the pace of job losses bottomed out. That from then on in, the pace of job losses got smaller and smaller over time, and pretty soon we had a real tangible recovery. And I think we're kind of the same way here. We're starting to, as this expansion matures, we're starting to see some of these fault lines pop up. But for the most part, most of the current indicators are good. The first chart shows you the big ones. In terms of the labor market for Oregon, and everything still up and to the right, except for, of course, the unemployment rate, which is taking a very large step downward. Obviously, there are data issues there. It doesn't really move like that. But nevertheless, encouraging. The problem is, as encouraging as the unemployment rate is, it's very much a backward-looking indicator. It tells us a lot more about yesterday than it does about tomorrow. But so before we move in, I will take a moment to aside and have Josh talk a little bit about some of these technical issues with the unemployment rate because it's getting a lot of attention recently.
Thanks, Mark. Chairman, for the record, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. The unemployment rate has dropped substantially in the last 3 months in Oregon. When we go out and give our public talks, or I talk to colleagues around the state, it's the only thing people want to talk about regarding the economy is we're 5.4% unemployment. It's below the U.S. rate. It's dropped quickly in the last couple months. There are some technical underlying issues there when you look at the various components that are in it. It's based on a small sample size. It's noisy month to month. However, the point still stands that over the last year or two, we've seen substantial improvement in the Oregon economy. There's no question about that. More people are employed. Less people are unemployed. Our labor force participation rate has even come back a little bit from the depths of the recession. It hasn't come back as much as our forecast calls for. We have a little bit more bump up in the labor force participation rate moving forward. However, those underlying components there, if you get them to move just right, it can drop the unemployment rate like a rock. In the last 3 months, it's been the largest decline on record in Oregon in the unemployment rate. This is unrevised data. Once the revisions come in, it's not going to look exactly like that line you see in front of you with a sharp wiggle downward. However, again, the point still stands that we've seen substantial improvement. More Oregonians are working. More Oregonians are looking for work at the same time. But the revisions should change that line a little bit moving forward.
That's right. And it really is encouraging that Oregon has regained this traditional growth advantage vis-a-vis other states. Here you see a chart with employment growth in the U.S. versus Oregon, and other than one period, which was during the Asian financial crisis when some of our main employers got their supply chains hammered directly, other than that, every single post-war expansion, Oregon outperforms its counterparts in other states. And the only problem is during recessions, we get hit a whole lot harder. So, and we just went through a decade where we had two major recessions, which was not good for our relative standing. However, it looks our growth advantage is as wide as ever right now, and it really looks like we are leading the country out of the recession. Our revenue growth right now is about twice what a typical state is seeing. So, why do we have this traditional advantage? As I've mentioned here in the past, there are really two big things going on. One is our industrial structure and our dependence on manufacturing and producers of goods and natural resource industries. All of these are very pro-cyclical industries, meaning they're very much synchronized with the broader business cycle, and they're very volatile with boom-bust cycles. And so our dependence on goods production and manufacturing gives us a little more volatility than other states, and we're certainly seeing that with our manufacturing payrolls once again outperforming everyone else. But another big part, and perhaps even bigger, is the in-migration, that when jobs are available in Oregon, people want to come here. And this is truly a remarkable competitive advantage relative to other states. It's not just that as people move here, we need more pizza places, consumer services, retail, and the like, but moreover, our businesses have ample supply of skilled young workers. You know, Oregon doesn't have MIT or Stanford University here, but we can certainly get those people to come. And not only can we get people who are educated there to come, but they'll come at a discount relative to other places, which is a huge advantage for our employers. And so we've seen this bounce back now, but there's not a whole lot more juice to go here other than an acceleration at the U.S. level. The gap doesn't get much wider than this. So what has changed? If we are going to, and we have, revised up the outlook and say, okay, we've become more optimistic about the future, and given where we are at the stage of the business cycle, these changes in trajectory end up compounding to hundreds of millions of dollars of additional revenue, it's difficult to do that without some kind of narrative to say, well, what have we seen that would make us become more optimistic? You know, what has changed in the data, either the revenue data or the employment data that changes our perspective? Well, right now it's really nothing's changed. But the only thing that's really changed is business and consumer sentiment, in particular in Oregon. And what do I mean by this, business sentiment? Well, as part of our process, we pull in a wide range of advisory groups and pretty diverse groups across political ideologies and across industries. And we vet the forecast with these groups. And by and large, our advisors told us that we were being spineless bureaucrats, roughly, and said, you need to add more outlook. We are more bullish about the future than are you. There are one or two that are perhaps as conservative as we are, but nevertheless, most said that felt more bullish than did we. Now, there are probably some reasons for it. You know, most of our council, they're business people and academics and don't necessarily look at these numbers every day, and nor do they have skin in the game, as do we. But nevertheless, it can't be ignored, particularly given the consensus that was out there and how diverse the group is. Our advisors don't have any formal decision-making authority, but at the same time, it's not Kabuki theater, and we do try to listen to them. And the sentiment is powerful. You know, this sentiment, business sentiment, particularly when it's so widely held, can actually generate economic growth, you know, become a self-fulfilling prophecy. If businesses and households are very bullish about the future, what do? They go out and they hire, they invest, and they spend, and that actually injects money into the economy and creates growth. And so there's a lot of reason to believe that, you know, that, and to buy into this, just because we're starting to see a little softening in some of the U.S. economic numbers doesn't necessarily mean that we won't have this real healthy, full throttle recovery going forward. And that's really what it is right now. In March, when we came in front of this group, I thought, weren't being cowardly. I thought it was a pretty aggressive forecast. What we provided you in March, the employment growth over the 15-17, the 2 years of the 15-17 biennium, almost perfectly matched the best 2 years of the housing boom. So it was a pretty darn aggressive forecast, I thought. But it's apparently not strong enough for the majority of economic watchers here in Oregon, or economy watchers in Oregon. So now we've gone even beyond that. The character of the last forecast we gave you had us keeping the growth rates we're seeing today for another year or so, and then having them tail off towards the end of the second half of the biennium. Now the flavor of the current forecast keeps these growth rates we're seeing now for almost the full 2 years before we start tailing off later. I think it's very important to buy into this sentiment. I think it is powerful, but at the same time, as powerful it is, sentiment is also very fickle, and can really sour overnight. And so once again, I think the downside risks are important to point out here, and the fact that so far we haven't had a dollar in the door for 15-17, and that hedging against this risk is probably a good management strategy. So I'm going to pass it to Josh to talk a little bit about some of these fault lines we're seeing in the U.S. Numbers. In particular, we've seen softening in manufacturing, and the orders and new orders for capital goods and surveys of purchasing managers at manufacturers. How many parts do you need to buy for next month? Things like that. We've started to see a little weakening there. And in particular, we're a little worried about the technology cycle and the manufacturers there. And the other place we've seen some weakening has been in retail sales and spending across the U.S., which is a little bit surprising in light of more income and lower gas prices and the like. But we've certainly seen some slowdown, and sales tax states are not doing particularly well right now. The slowdown actually happened before we got the bad weather out east, so there's some concern there. But for the most part, I think we can wash away these, or at least Josh, who is far more optimistic than I am, will do his best to do that.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark. As Mark's been talking about, right, is we're after probably a good year or so where there's hardly any economic indicator that looks bad or is turned down or anything like that, we're starting to see the manufacturing cycle start to wane. Here, what you see in front of you are the new orders for capital goods, and then also the overall industrial production in the U.S. They're starting to turn down in the last 6 months, or at least flatline. It's a little bit worrisome from that, particularly as a manufacturing state. The technology cycle has waned a little bit. 2014 was not the best year for some of our technology producers. And the outlook for that maybe is not as robust as it was just a few years ago. However, it's still bright for most of our major technology producers. And I think a lot of this manufacturing slowdown can be directly attributed to the oil and gas industries and the extraction that's going on basically in the heartland and in the plains within this country with the fracking boom we've seen over the last 10, 15 years. And sure enough, we're seeing these manufacturing numbers start to soften and soften a good amount for the last 6 months. But if we go to the next slide, it's also highly localized. Here we're looking at the basically layoffs across the country, the initial claims for unemployment insurance. So far, the bulk of the country is at an all-time low in terms of the number of layoffs in the economy. However, in the epicenter of the fracking boom, North Dakota and Texas, they're skyrocketing. They're up considerably. And so we're seeing a very significant impact from the pullback in oil and gas exploration due to the lower energy prices and lower oil prices today. However, so far, it is maintained within those regional economies that both benefited to the upside. They're now feeling it on the downside of the oil price swings and the investment cycle. So it's certainly weighing on the national numbers. It's impacting the manufacturing cycle more broadly. But so far, we're seeing it, again, localized at the regional level to those regions of the country that specialize in it have seen the biggest benefit. More concerning, though, however, as Mark talked about, was the consumer, right? We talked about you in front of you 3 months ago, the oil-related savings windfall that consumers are experiencing. It's the equivalent of a large tax cut. It's hundreds of dollars per household, maybe $700-$800 per household for the typical Oregonian, related to their gasoline price savings. What are they doing with it? We thought, the economists more generally thought that we'd see a boost in spending on everything else, right? More clothes, more cars, more supplies for their school children, things like that. Maybe they're going to buy a new house or something like that. So far, we're not seeing that. The retail sales have been weak. It looks like their consumers saving a lot of it. And that makes sense, right, if you start thinking about it. If you think gas prices are going to go back up, that we're going to go back to $4 a gallon, it's only temporary that we're down around $2.50 to $3 per gallon, you're going to save that windfall, and you're not sure. You don't want to stick your neck out and invest it or put it somewhere else. So that's what seems to be a lot of what's going on. The consumer has more income today than they ever have overall, at least in aggregate in the economy, and they're saving even more at the pump. However, they're not spending it yet. To the extent that the belief is that oil prices will remain lower moving forward and gas prices of more like $3 a gallon is the new normal, not $4 a gallon, you would expect to see the broader consumer sales start to pick up. But this is a linchpin in the outlook, right, is that the manufacturing cycle is waning a little bit, but we think the consumer will pick up some of the slack due to the gasoline-related savings. We haven't seen it yet, but it's still early. Gas prices have only been low for 5 months now. They've only and as such, we're expecting an increase moving forward. So, okay, so even with all the good news we're seeing in the Oregon economy, you know, strong job gains of over 3%, declining unemployment rate, things like that, we know the economy is not fully healthy. Right here is what we call the total employment gap, where we factor in both the cyclical unemployment, again, that's what you typically measure in the unemployment rate, but we know we have a much lower labor force participation rate than we have historically. A lot of it's due to aging. However, aging alone can only explain half to three quarters of the decline in the labor force participation rate. The other part of it is most likely due to a weak economy. People don't believe there's a job opportunity for them, so they've just given up looking entirely. That's what's been going on in recent years, and you can see here sort of the medium shade of gray is the largest component of the slack or the underutilization in our labor market today, and that has to do with the labor force participation rate gap. Moving forward, we expect that to continue to increase. We've picked up somewhere around a percentage point of labor force participation rate over the last 18 months. We think we're going to pick up maybe 1.5 percentage points more over the next 2 years. We're not asking for a lot. We're not going back to previous rates of labor force participation rate. However, with a stronger economy and stronger wage gains, which Mark will talk about here in a second, the labor market is doing substantially better than it has in recent years, and that'll continue to compound on itself. And somewhere by the end of the next biennium, it's looking like the Oregon economy may finally be back to what you could call full employment, where the feel-good nature of the economy is back. People are employed full-time. They have, you know, decent wage gains. And job growth overall is pretty strong. It's going to take some time before we fully work off this total employment gap, but we're making progress. We're 50, 60, maybe not quite two-thirds of the way back there yet today. However, the course of the 15-17 biennium, we should get there, provided the economic forecast comes to pass.
And this is what the monetary policymakers at the federal level are really focused on, is this gap. We have the unemployment rate in most states is down to a normal or reasonably normal level at the top line, but there's still this slack. There's still this incomplete labor market recovery. And what are they waiting for at the U.S. level, the federal policymakers, to stop their accommodative policy and to say that, okay, the labor market is tight and we are somewhere back near full employment? Well, the one signal they're really waiting for are wage gains. When workers become scarce and hard to find, their wages get bid up. Employers are forced to pay more for workers when they become more scarce and hard to find. And so at the U.S. level, we've only seen a little modest improvement in wage growth, and that's really what folks are waiting for before we say that we're off and running. Well, a lot of folks have gone ahead and taken that U.S. story and applied it to Oregon. I think it's conventional wisdom here that we're really not seeing any wage gains here in Oregon either, but that's it couldn't be farther from the truth. We're back up to housing boom levels of wage gains, and in particular the withholdings out of our Oregon personal income taxes, 8%, 9%, 10% over the last few quarters. Really doing about as well as we do. Well, we're not going to get back here in the graph you see in the 1990s. We were doing better, but that includes higher rates of inflation as well. We expect, you know, more wage growth in higher inflation periods, given that we're in the same sort of inflation setting as we were in 05. This right now is really about as good as it gets, and that's encouraging. But what it has done is it's led us and it's led our advisors to suggest that we prop up wage growth a little bit as well as employment growth. And those two things together, you know, really do compound over the biennium and give us some more additional resources. But now, while average wage gains are back, I think it's been very well publicized in Oregon that not everyone is benefiting from this. And we're going to make a couple comments about that.
Right. As Mark said, you know, the ongoing nature of the employment recovery, where we've had increasing job opportunities at both the high wage level and the low wage level in terms of occupations. High wages are doctors and attorneys and managers and engineers and folks like that. And the low wage are some of the service providers, nail salons and janitorial crews and things like that. That's where the job opportunities have been increasing in concentration basically for the last 30 years. And this recession and recovery has been no different. You can see both Oregon's gains are a little bit larger than typical state over the full business cycle. But again, they're heavily concentrated in both the high wage, where we've significantly outgained the typical state in the nation, and then the low wage, where maybe we're a little bit less on the low wage gains than the typical state. However, the red numbers in the middle wage, your construction workers, your installation, maintenance, and repair workers, your teachers, your community service workers, those types of folks have seen the largest job losses and the slowest growth coming out of the recovery. And again, this is where most Oregonians and most Americans are employed. You know, 50-60% of the workforce, of the employed workforce, is right there in those red numbers. With that being said, the 2014 number is the best we've seen in 7 years. It's still low. It's still lackluster. The job growth is still slower than we're seeing elsewhere in the economy. However, they are slowly improving. The overall, the number of middle-wage jobs in Oregon is somewhere around a third to 40% of the way back to where it used to be prior to the Great Recession, whereas the low-wage job and the high-wage jobs are an all-time high. We've never had more of them in the economy. The middle-wage jobs still aren't all the way back. It's going to be a few years of strong growth before we get there. But as the housing market revives and the construction activity picks up, or should pick up further, then those construction jobs will come back as the K-12 budgets continue to improve, property taxes continue to increase. We should see some more of these middle-wage jobs come back. However, these ongoing processes where the middle-wage jobs are squeezed disproportionately is expected to continue moving forward at the same time. But this is one of the natures of the economy that we've been seeing.
Excuse me, what are the definitions of middle wages?
That's a good point. In terms of the wage level themselves, we're looking at median wages by occupation. And so that's around the range is $25,000 to $50,000 per year per worker. For full-time work.
Thank you.
Yeah, that defined middle has nothing to do with spending power or whatnot. It's just literally the middle of the distribution. So in addition to having this differences in performance across occupations and skill levels, we've also had divergent performance across regions. Here we see see much at all but in terms of the labels, but it's easy to tell what these are. The size is obviously big, and our big major metropolitan area, big counties in the Portland metropolitan area are all the way back. Those are the green ones at the top. In the middle, the bluish stuff, these are our middle metropolitan areas, the Willamette Valley ones, Eugene, Salem, the like. These places started recovering a little bit later, and thank you. Started recovering a little bit later and have gotten two-thirds of the way back to of their net job losses in the recession. And then at the below, the orange and the red smaller counties are predominantly our smaller rural counties, which have only gotten on average about a third of their jobs back and have only started to improve very recently. But that said, right now, in the unrevised data, we're looking at 9 out of 10 counties having added jobs in recent months, which is really remarkable and almost unprecedented in Oregon that we've had these widespread gains. Now, in some of these smaller counties, we're talking about 20 or 30 jobs, but the needle has finally moved in the upward direction, which in and of itself is encouraging. But as much as it's encouraging, it in part feeds into some of our more conservative nature of our quantitative models than some of the top line advice we're getting from other economy watchers. When we build up our expectations of economic growth from the bottom up, either through adding up all the little industries or adding up all the regions of the state, it's hard to get acceleration or to maintain where we are today. You know, the regional story is an easy one. You know, if we have 9 out of 10 counties growing and that never happens, and we have some of our mid-metropolitan areas growing as fast as ever, at, you know, at top speed, Salem, Bend at 7% growth in employment is off like a rocket. You know, these places can't accelerate. And so what's left? It's the Portland metropolitan area. And the Portland metropolitan area has been growing at this steady 2% rate now for 5 years in a row. And I don't know if I have a story that says they're going to step up to 3. It's possible, but, you know, it's hard to really build up from the bottom up. And same is true from the industry level, trying to say, well, which industry is going to drive us to improve. It really has to come from above. And that's where I think it certainly is possible, and particularly from the U.S. outlook. If the U.S. economic recovery picks up more, we most likely will get dragged along with it. But along with that comes the downside risks, which would suggest, you know, and I think right now it's particularly important to talk about risks because, again, we have this nature of this forecast that we're providing today is that we stay at this full throttle recovery all the way through this next biennium before tailing off. So what can come in the way of that? What sort of shocks are we looking at that could derail this blow a hole in the budget? Well, one of them we look for is what people are into bubbles or whatever you want to call imbalances in the economy in some way or another. The fact that what we've seen in the past couple of cycles, we saw the stock market and technology firms blow up one time where, you know, it didn't matter what your price earning ratios, that wasn't important anymore. We had the housing downturn, which was very similar in terms of lending standards and the like. And in financial contagion, well, you know, where would we look now? What sort of things are worrying us now? One that stands out here is education and health services. Here we're looking at jobs growth over the recession and recovery to date. And really, you'll see only 4 industries are back to their pre-recession peaks or above it. Professional and business services, that's a good one. A lot of high-paid jobs there. Government, that's also good if you're a public servant like myself. You know, government in good times and bads, it's pretty stable. Leisure and hospitality up a little bit most recently, but the big one there is education and health services. And there is clearly some speculative stuff going on there. It's not that there isn't going to be a growing need for this, right? We harp on the demographics and the aging population every time we come here. But at the same time, just because there are going to be a lot of old people out there doesn't make every investment in a wheelchair repair place a good bet. And it seems like, you know, a lot of money is just flowing this way, and what makes it more problematic for an economist is that there in this industry, there really are no working market forces. There are a whole lot of barriers to markets, which can obviously lead to imbalances over time. I was asked to teach a class in health economics at Penn at one point, and I was worried because I hadn't done anything with it before. And so the first thing I did was I ran out and borrowed syllabuses from or syllabi or whatever it is from other professors who have taught it before. And instantly I was, put all my fears to rest because it wasn't really about healthcare. It was all about something I knew about, which was market failure. They talk about market, there's market failure at every step of the way. We all know about the third-party payments and the fact that you're getting paid for procedures in hospitals rather than healthcare outcomes. And we have this middleman in terms of insurance companies and whatnot that go on and that distort the markets. But there, it goes well beyond that on both the supply and the demand side. Obviously, on the supply side, we have a tremendous amount of market power. It's not a coincidence that the healthcare inflation has slowed at the same time that businesses can no longer pay higher rates. We don't see double digit inflation anymore just because of the consumers won't swallow it or unable to. So there's obviously some concern on the supply side, and like I say, there's also the speculation going on there. But the demand side is the labor side is messed up too. In terms of healthcare employment, we have tremendous shortages and high wages for a lot of our occupations. Many of those occupations, the shortages are self-inflicted. In particular, physicians, And physicians have a very powerful labor organization that gets to choose how many of each specialty get produced every year. You know, they have a residency and matching program. And so if you can control the numbers out there, you can certainly control the wages. And so that's a concern. And another concern is a big one tying into adoption of new technology and IT. Josh was talking about the middle wage jobs and how so many of those have been decimated largely because of technological change and technological innovation. We don't need as many administrative assistants anymore. We don't need as many retail trade folks. We have inventory management, and we have, you know, scanning technology and whatnot, and we've really reduced the need for these middle age occupations, bank tellers and the like, because we have ATM machines. Well, with market power, a lot of health service firms have been able to fully resist incorporating any of these technological changes, and we know from history and other industries, at the point when they do have to swallow some of these, it's not going to be good for the payrolls. That said, I'm ready to invest in healthcare myself, so I don't want to badmouth it too much.
Another risk that's out there regarding the economy, and it's a bit of a known, is the drought, right? Obviously, we know there's a severe drought coming up from California and much of the Southwest. You know, a good chunk, up to half of Oregon counties are inflicted to some degree today, whether they're on the official drought list or not, to a certain degree is a little bit irrelevant. Much of them are receiving some of the Small Business Administration loans or potentially can receive some of that. But there's a large and somewhat unknown impact there. You know, in California last year is a multi-billion dollar impact of the severe drought, and this year it's going to be even larger. And the industries that are impacted most within California, according to a study that came out of UC Davis, are the ones that are in the regions of the state of Oregon that are also impacted by drought. It's more of your cattle and less your dairies. It's more of your crops and your grains and less your fruits and your nuts in terms of the agricultural products. And so that's a little bit worrisome for many of our particular rural areas. And Mark just got through talking about a lot of those smaller orange and red counties at the bottom of that bubble chart are also the ones that are also facing some of the drought pressures moving forward. Of course, along with increased drought, provided that we also, unfortunately, could see some additional wildfire damage and increased cost and budget pressure there at the same time, and then also lower rain and lower snowpack levels mean less hydropower, and so more other types of energy use across the country and across the region. So these are just some of the impacts moving forward. We don't have a number on them specifically in terms of what the impact will be. However, we also know they can impact local regional economies. You know, we talk about the 2001 recession being a high-tech recession. Portland was hurt hard, Seattle, San Francisco, Austin, Texas, Boston, all those types of places that you think of as tech centers were hurt quite a bit. However, the Klamath Basin was also going through massive water issues in the early 2000s as well, and you can see here Klamath County employment declined substantially further than Portland employment did and took even longer to recover coming out of it. And so you can see the impact of water issues more broadly on some of the rural economies and the regional economies can be quite severe and certainly is a significant event. And again, the drought, the ongoing drought, the exact severity and the duration of it are unknown. But, you know, we can see that its impact is tangible in some of these regional economies. And then lastly, for a risk moving forward, is the terms of trade. The Oregon dollar, where we kind of rebalance the trade-weighted average based on our major trading partners on the Pacific Rim versus the U.S. major currency partners, which also includes, you know, the Europe and things like that, has appreciated 15-20% in the last year and a half. It's making the terms of trade substantially less in our favor. The way this worked through in the previous decade with a stronger dollar, even though it was depreciating, you see those lines going down over the course of the 2000s, we had a global savings glut. We had a lot of imports. The U.S. was a stronger economy than the typical one, but we imported a lot of our goods and our products, and we had no manufacturing cycle at the U.S. level. In Oregon, we did. We regained more of our jobs in the 2000s than the typical manufacturing state. However, in terms of the goods you buy at the store and products and things like that, that's the concern here at the same time, is that if the dollars continue to appreciate, it makes our exporting goods more expensive to consumers abroad, and so therefore, and it makes their goods cheaper to us, and so therefore we could start to see a trade deficit increase and hurt the manufacturing industries even more so than they're typically used to seeing. And so that's one risk moving forward. I don't think the market is increasing. The market doesn't have increased expectations for further appreciation in the U.S. dollar. However, they don't have it declining substantially either. It's kind of a flatline outlook in terms of the U.S. dollar will be stronger, but maybe we're kind of at the strength that should be, quote unquote, today moving forward.
That's right. So that, in conclusion, those are really the main risks we see, in addition to what we're getting in the indicators in terms of the, it looks like the manufacturing cycle is winding down, and it looks like, you know, the weakness in retail spending, and then we have these three that I think we needed to highlight: the health services, drought, and the global savings glut in our terms of trade. So hopefully, or not hopefully, but if something comes to pass, it's most likely going to be one of these, or an asteroid from, you know, outer space. So, in terms of where do we go with the outlook? Well, we really feel strongly about our medium to long term outlook. It comes from the labor force dynamics. Over time, we've seen in periods of expansion, Oregon's job growth become weaker and weaker. In the 60s and 70s, we had all sorts of good stuff going on in terms of labor force dynamics. We had rapid population growth, plus we had increases in participation among women and minorities. Those participation increases topped out in the 90s and 2000s, and so we took a little step down in terms of growth to 3%. And now the participation gains have flipped, where we're actually losing labor force participation as a lot of our highly skilled and highly paid experienced workers retire from the workforce. So going forward with these workforce dynamics, we don't expect the average year in our expansions to match what we've seen in past periods of economic expansion. But that said, it doesn't mean you can't have one or two good years. And this chart, I think, is really what drives a lot of our advisors to push us to be stronger, because, you know, it really, keeping a modest outlook doesn't really pass the eyeball test. This is the pattern of the new outlook, and it does look, you know, by the eyeball, looks like our past recoveries or past expansions, where we've had a couple of real good boom years in the middle. And so that's what we're pushing for here. And it's we should have superimposed our March forecast, which would show this turning down a little bit sooner. But the timing of this, taking these best 2 years and putting them right on, superimposing them right on top of the 15-17 biennium does do a number on the revenue outlook, which we'll turn to now. So for as I mentioned before, for 11-13 or 13-15, it's all about tracking now. The economic forecast doesn't have enough time to really impact our outlook. It's about everything that's coming in the door, and we're just starting to get an idea about how that April season was for Oregon, and it looks like it's going to be a good one. Here, these S curves show the last 5 years how our final payments, tax payments, have come in over time, and what really jumps out is it's really, we don't know anything until we really get into May or are really unable to tell anything. We start getting bugged about how things are, you know, even in the first quarter, you know, January, February, March, but that's really the preseason. It really takes until they start opening up these envelopes until we start finding out. In the last 4 years, you know, around tax day, we've been always about at the same place, 10 or 15% up on the year before, but where we land, you know, after the dust settles is completely different. In 2013, it was up 25%. In 2014, it ended up down 5. It looks like we're going to end up somewhere around 23 or 24% larger than last year. this time, which will be just a hair shy of what we forecast. We forecast about 25%. So it looks like this time we got the tough part right. These year-end payments, the capital gains, and the investment income we got right. But what we did not get right this year so far has been the labor-related income, the wages and the refunds paid to workers. The job market has been much stronger than we expected. The wages have picked up at the same time. So, like I said, we're really starting to see withholding growth 8, 9, 10%, which is double the typical income tax state right now. And as a result of this extra labor income, the 13-15 biennium has now we expect to be even stronger. Now, there's still, like I say, there's still some risk here in the typical year. This is going to change by about $150 million in the typical year by the time we get all of the numbers in and close the books. But as of right now, we are looking at being $182 million over the 2% kicker threshold, which would generate a kicker on the order of $473 million to pay out in the next biennium. No longer can I blame it on the $87 million generated by the special session, because even without that, we would still be over the threshold. But of course, that $87 million is refunded to taxpayers as well in the next year. So, but there are a lot of moving parts here with how this kicker works through available resources. So I'll let Josh make a couple comments on that.
Yeah, so you take the combination of stronger receipts coming in the door today, and then you carry, you know, and then you talk about a stronger outlook, mostly from jobs and wages, and you we see at the bottom line there on the left-hand side is a net available resources of about $463 million that you guys, along with Ways and Means and the rest of your elected counterparts, have additional for spending in the upcoming biennium, provided that the 13-17 numbers don't increase at the same time in terms of expenditures. Overall net available resources are up by $463 million. You can see how the composition there and a lot of the moving parts. The kicker is now larger than it used to be, so that's increased by $121 million over what we told you 3 months ago. Kicker offsets are also included within this calculation. What those are is Oregonians that have a debt outstanding to the state, whether you owe back taxes or whether you owe community college tuition or child support payments, or you have a judgment against you for property crimes or whatever it may be, where you have debt outstanding to the state, instead of getting your previously your kicker check or now a credit, instead of receiving that yourself, the state will go ahead and just take that and as part of the processing. And so we'll see some offsets to the kicker. So the amount that's paid out will actually be less than the 473 just because of the debts outstanding, and that the Department of Revenue is able to offset some of those, again, debts outstanding across a variety of programs. It's just not back taxes for income taxes. It's across other programs and agencies at the same time. And then, of course, we've also increased the lottery outlook, which I will talk about here in a little bit. And so all told, the numbers of available resources for 15-17 is up hundreds of millions of dollars, mostly due to the economic outlook. However, a third of it is tracking from the current biennium, and then the rest, the two-thirds, is due to the improvement in the economic outlook.
Yeah, one further comment on the offsets. We're expecting these to be smaller than they have been in the past. In the last kicker we put out was $60 million worth of offsets. This kicker, for one, is less than half the size of the one we put out last time. And also, now that we've moved away from handing out a check into a credit on your taxes, it's not clear that all of these offsets will get collected this time, in particular the non-DOR debt, community college debt and the like. It's difficult to see how that'll work through. Folks will have to file, and then, you know, which is okay with DOR, because then if they have accounts receivable, that just affects that. But, you know, in terms of these other agencies, the judicial fee or whatever, court fees and the like, and like tuition and child support and things like that, I'm not sure we'll be able to
to collect as much of that as in the past. So we've revised down that estimate.
So what's important to most people, you know, we're the only ones in the state who don't like, you know, hearing about the kicker because, you know, it shows that we're incompetent. But for everybody else, they're into the money.
No kicker, no cuts, no ifs, ands, or buts. No kicker, no cuts, no ifs, ands, or buts. No kicker, no cuts, no ifs, ands, or buts. No kicker, no cuts, no ifs, ands, or buts. No kicker, no cuts. No ifs, ands, or buts. No kicker, no cuts. No ifs, ands, or buts. No kicker, no cuts. No ifs, ands, or buts. No kicker, no cuts. No ifs, ands, or buts. No kicker, no cuts. No ifs, ands, or buts. No kicker, no cuts.
They did a better job with the sound bites than we did.
Well, I think when you said incompetent, that's what started.
I was wondering when they were going to get that.
All right, so these folks don't have their way and we do get a kicker, this is what it's going to look like. So for the average tax filer, we're looking at $284 with these numbers will change, and these are just quickie estimates to give an idea. So, you know, $284 per household, but that obviously, given our progressive tax structure in Oregon, that changes across income levels. In particular, when you get over the $350,000 a year and you're in the top 1% of earners in Oregon, then we're talking about, you know, a significant check of $5,400, something along those lines for our high income filers. Of course, if you're making more than $300,000, you probably don't care that much about the $5,000 to begin with. So in terms of our personal income tax collections, this is over time. It's kind of tough chart to read, but we're back up to, we've accelerated here this last fiscal year, 2015. You know, we've had real strong growth, and now we're, at this point, we're really at double digits per year growth rate right now, which would be, you know, a 20% growth over the biennium, really almost back to what you would consider the good old days. But the point that we're really trying to highlight in terms of the history of the personal income tax is that we have, just because we've gone for, as you see here, 5 years and had strong growth, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're about to collapse, that there's some kind of term limit to these expansions and this, you know, growth in terms of revenue. If you ignore legislative changes that took place in the 80s, we really, after that severe recession, we went nearly 20 years without a major revenue event in Oregon. So there is the potential or historical precedent that this growth could continue, you know, for the foreseeable future. Although the other thing that this chart shows is just, you know, how big the swings are, and that, you know, the revenues certainly are a boom bust proposition. And as always, the big reason for that, or one of the large reasons for that, are investment type incomes, the personal taxable personal income that's dependent upon choices of taxpayers, and when they decide to realize these gains for tax purposes, cash in their investments and the like. This can be extremely volatile over time, and it proved to be yet again this year. We saw this year, it appears from early estimates, that we're going to end up almost doubling capital gains on the year, realized capital gains, about 83% growth, I think, is what we have in right now. So it has been a tremendous year in terms of taxable investment income. The future of this taxable investment income now is pretty cloudy, hard to say where we're going to go. In particular, it's tied to the performance of equity markets, which are always difficult to give an outlook for. But the conventional wisdom right now is that as the economy continues to improve and federal policymakers start to raise interest rates, and we start to see interest rates go up,
this is going to take a lot of the wind out of some of the asset appreciation and some of these taxable events. And so given the what goes up must come down nature of these capital gains in the past, we have a pretty flat and declining outlook for them over the next biennium or two. So here's a place where, you know, there certainly is both upside and downside risk going forward. But for this next biennium, I think, or at least at this next tax year, I think there's the possibility that we will do much better than this. But it's very difficult to budget for the $10 billion in capital gains that we saw at the very peak of the housing boom, because it's not very intuitive how we would get there. But that said, it's not impossible. And given the wild ride that this has been in the past, I think we have a considerable amount of upside here in terms of the revenue outlook. But in terms of the overall revenue picture, it's this graph of the personal income tax changes. I typically showed to in order to highlight the fact that these big millions of dollars of changes in available resources aren't necessarily associated with a very qualitative difference in the lines. Usually these lines are smack dab right on top of each other, and so it'll be 50 million or 100 million different, but from the eyeball you can't really tell that it's qualitatively a different forecast. Well, that's not necessarily true this time. As you see here, we've got a little bump there in our outlook for income taxes, a bump that looks a lot like what we saw in the tech boom or in the housing boom for a couple of years. That's due both to starting off at a higher level. We've ended 13-15 with these strong numbers and this expected kicker, and that's started launching us up to a little bit of a higher level. And then when we add another year or two of strong growth to that, we're this 2015 and 2016 budget period does certainly stand out, and it does look more like these past revenue booms we've had. But obviously that's uncertain, or at least the stuff that's going to come in the next biennium is. Other place we have some upside risk and uncertainty is with our corporate tax collections. We're still trying to work our way through the data issues. Once we have a year or two of the new system, we should get these ironed out. But for now, we're still way up at a record level in terms of corporate collections. There's a lot going on there with tax law changes and record profitability, plus the systems changes. So we're trying to, it's hard to get our handle on where this is going to land over the long haul. But for now, we're just holding to the model we had before the new data came in, and just changing along with the outlook for profit. So we're not seeing much change, and in particular, we have our expectation anchored at some $550 million a year flat level. So not a lot of growth over the next biennium, but at the same time, this is a step up from what we've seen in the past. As you see here, as volatile as it is, in the past we've in a typical year it's $350-400 million a year, and now we've taken another step up from that. So while there's not growth in this biennium, it's not particularly a conservative forecast either. But I think that's reasonable. As you see here, the tax reforms that we've highlighted, all except for the small business tax cut, most of those would result in increased tax liability for corporations, and so landing at a higher level is probably reasonable. But exactly how high that is yet to be determined. There was a lot of churn in terms of the Great Recession when we're putting in these tax law changes, and so ironing out what's doing the pushing and pulling is yet to be determined. But as you see here, we've smoothed it out a little bit from the last forecast, as some of the newest numbers out of the of corporate collections have topped off. We haven't seen that big spike that we were expecting 3 months ago, and so we don't have the as sharp of a pullback either. But again, we're going to wait and see until we have a better idea of where these corp collections land. Another place we have some upside risk is in the
long moribund lottery revenues, where the it appears we've started to take off along with some investment in new technology.
Right, so we've seen the fundamental improvements in the economy in recent years, where the average wages and the income for per household have been increasing, but we haven't seen a broader increase in some discretionary spending like video lottery. However, the video lottery is currently undergoing a capital replacement program in which all the terminals that you see out at the bars and restaurants you may or may not visit yourself are being replaced over multiple years. Well, the first wave is out. There's two new machines in every bar and restaurant in the state of Oregon. And not coincidentally, we've seen a strong uptick in sales. Again, we've seen strong fundamentals in the economy. Gas prices are low. Household budgets are better than they have been in quite some time. But it certainly appears that the new machines have been the catalyst to unlock some of this discretionary spending. And the fact that it coincides with the rollout of the new machines in every region of the state. Every region of the state is currently growing at double digits in terms of video lottery growth. Portland and Coos Bay and Kay Falls, they're all growing at double digits growth in video lottery sales right now. As soon as the new machines came online, we've seen this growth here, and you can see the graph. They're starting to top out. You know, you can't grow at double digits forever. They're starting to the novelty factor, the bump, the initial sales bump that coincides with a new attractive option in the marketplace does fade out. And so we kind of have this coming back down next year. Next year's growth will be relatively close to zero. It'll be a one-time bump, but that also is a one-time bump that also results kind of in a level shift up in the overall outlook. And so available resources for lotteries up about $40 million next biennium, which is a fairly large change given the base size of that is much smaller than the general fund. And it's up a little bit more than that moving forward in the outer years as well.
Yeah, and you see that in the outer years, that these are real significant changes in terms of the lottery outlook. And once we get out 10 years, we're looking at $100 million a biennium. So that's real money. And we add that to the personal income tax changes here, and we see the changes in available resources for policymakers. And like I say, these are pretty big. 13-15 up 164. And next biennium up $305 million in terms of general fund and lottery combined resources. So that's encouraging. Again, the bottom line outlook is that we feel that over the extended horizon, we're going to get to more modest rates of growth than we've been accustomed to in the past. These next 2 years are going to be pretty good ones. Here we see our long-run revenue growth. If not for the kicker, this 2015-17 lines would look very much like 2011-13 and 2013-15. They'd be up there in the just south of 15% growth in terms of the overall biennium general fund, which is what we've become accustomed to in periods of economic expansion. So you're looking at, if not for the kicker, we would have one more year up there in that 15% range of personal income tax growth before slowing down to these trend rates around 10% for the foreseeable future. So that's the bottom line with the outlook. One more year of good growth, revised upward largely because of really overwhelmingly positive business sentiment that's out there. Once again, there's a lot of risk involved, and as many of you working on reserve fund legislation know, the amount of reserves you need to cover this is pretty significant. But the good news is, right now we have more reserves, particularly with this big ending balance having yet been appropriated by the legislature, we have bigger reserves than ever before. The combined
today between the ESF, the rainy day fund, and the ending balance to 11-13, we're talking $900 million in reserves, which is the largest we've ever seen. It's still only about 5% of spending. And, you know, when some of the previous work has been done, we've talked about 7% reserve funds to insure against an average-sized recession, much larger than that to insure against a great recession-type event. But
we're doing better, and people have noticed. The rating agencies bring it up all the time. Senator Hass, when negotiating the Measure 67 corporate minimum tax, to put an automatic deposit in the rainy day fund. The rating agencies really love that. And, you know, the more we can do that, the better. But, again, right now, with this huge ending balance, I think we do have an opportunity to save, you know, to the extent that that the legislature can protect that and squirrel it away. We're starting to get up into some decent levels of reserves, or at least it would help should things not live up to this rosy outlook. So with that, that's it for our prepared comments, but we'd be happy to take any questions you have.
Well, on that note, first of all, thank you for your presentation. Nobody up here thinks you're incompetent.
Thank you.
Slide 27, on that same note that you were just making with the capital gains, we have a bill that's on the Senate floor on Monday that will take out those top bars on the right side, and that will even further put the markets at ease and hopefully by sequestering those capital gains into the stability fund, we'll be better off in the future.
Senator Hass, and other states have certainly done that. California and Massachusetts are very happy about how the way their legislation is working out.
Right. And as you know, I'm thrilled that more people are working, more Oregonians are making more money, but still, you know, the substantial spike is a spike, and this whole building has been basically on hold for the last couple of weeks waiting for whatever it is you had to release, and that shouldn't be the case. With a more stable system, these revenue forecasts up and down shouldn't be as significant as they are, which points to our volatility problem. I'll get off my soapbox. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the comment. Of course, amplify your comment, the Pew report that we were all familiar with made it very clear that our best strategy for managing long-term budgets is to figure out ways to remove portions of the most volatile piece of our tax system into a reserve account, and that's exactly what the bill that you're talking about, or the one that Representative Reed has in the House, would do. I wanted to talk a little bit about the kicker slide that you snuck in on page 25 of the report, and simply note that something I think most Oregonians don't realize, and that is that it's directly related to the amount of taxes that you pay. So if you pay a lot of taxes, your refund is pretty big. For most Oregonians, your estimated refund is credit is $144 or less, whereas in the top group we're talking about thousands of dollars and maybe tens of thousands of dollars for the top income earners. I think that's very much worth noting that's the way it works. Also, would note that the group that we're hearing out in the hall, that were in here a little bit ago, were wearing signs that basically said, if I recall, that they didn't like the idea of a kicker. They'd rather we spend it on higher education. Of course, I come from a district where I've got two major universities and colleges, University of Oregon and Lane Community College, both of which have students attending who are paying enormous tuition rates because we have significantly cut education funding in the legislature. If we were actually using this money from these high-income earners productively, we might be able to actually lower some of those costs. So I appreciate I'm not supporting the way they did it, but I think the message that they're presenting to us is an important one. And I appreciate the fact that you're carrying the same message to us in a different way with this slide.
Senator Boquist?
Well, with that good warm startup here, I'm sure Representative Barnhart, Josh is with you. So my question here is, Josh, you said go spend, as we always do, and there's always plenty of places, low income, K-12, so on and so forth. But to the dear state economists, unless I'm missing something here in all of the verbiage, and the asteroid hasn't hit us yet, and no, you're not incompetent, but I think what your summary here is, and you wrote it, is we have an aggressive forecast with high risk, and you were saying something slightly different is you might want to consider saving a little and not spending it, either in the sort of mechanism that both chairs and both and the vice chairs have been working on, or in a time phase, maybe we should wait a couple of quarters here to see whether this starts to come to fruition, because you're saying two different things here, and I'm a little leery about spending regardless of the cost based on what you said. This is the most high risk I've seen in a decade I've been in the building.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, this point in the cycle, we're just so dependent on this outlook because it really compounds over the coming biennium and does create some uncertainty. And another point to make is that we, in terms of our forecast, and I think this is a good a silver lining for the kicker law would be, in terms of our forecast, you guys really get the straight dope relative to other legislatures in other states, where in other states the bureaucrat like myself has an incentive to be conservative and lowball these forecasts and show up with good news. Right now, all the other income tax states are showing up, oh, big April surprise, you know, we got all this capital gains, here's all your extra money. Well, for us, you know, because they didn't forecast 25% year over year, because the implications of a mistake on the downside and the upside are different. Well, I think it is preferable for the elected policymakers to determine how much to save and put away, and not necessarily a bureaucrats. And so the one thing we can take away from this, we have a lot of risk. We're sticking our neck out, and it's certainly an aggressive forecast. But at least in this state, it's our elected officials that get to determine how to manage this risk.
Follow-up, please.
Just would you comment a little bit? I mean, you made mention some of the slides, we've had previous downturns, and you know, one of the problems with the downturn is the supply chain issue. And we have the Port of Portland, which is, I guess, I'll jump out, has been decimated with the departure of containerized shipping almost wholeheartedly across the board, almost 90%. Comment on supply chain issues now that we frankly don't have an export port?
Yeah, we talked a lot about sorry, Senator Boquist. We talked a lot about the ports with our advisory groups this time, and for the most part, folks feel okay about the fact, are happy that it's only the container service, because the container service in terms of the Port of Portland is, you know, only one part of their whole business portfolio and not the biggest part, you know, in terms of moving stuff. And so that's good news. And the other thing advisors bring up is say, well, if you look at our comparison metropolitan areas, you want to know who we're like, you know, Austin or Denver or Minneapolis or whatnot, these places don't have ports. But I'm not so sure I buy that, because we are really more tied into goods production than our other places. But I don't think it's good to be sanguine about losing the container service and whatnot, and it will add costs to a lot of businesses. And the other thing that I think gets glossed over about it is when you say that container service isn't much part of the port's business, it's true, but we don't really care so much about the financials of the Port of Portland as much as we do about the broader economy. And the one thing that this container service does, when you move goods and bulk products, we get a lot of really good jobs in terms of warehousing and transportation and logistics and all, you know, and the downstream suppliers. And I think that's really where we're going to look for the most pain in terms of the cutbacks of the port.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I want to clarify one thing with Dr. Warner. As you know, the school budget that we passed, 40% of excess of revenues that may come in a forecast like this will go to the K-12 budget. Paul, can you tell us what amount we're talking about and where that math gets.
Okay, I think it's the slide 24, Mark, the previous one that shows the changes. To the resources. The co-chair's commitment was the change in the revenue projection for 15-17. So that's broken out here. The forecast was up 364, but if you adjust for the kicker there, that net effect, 121 plus the 21 is 100. So the change there in the forecast is 264. And if you take 264, the co-chair's commitment was 40% of that number. So it's about $105 million, doing the math from that change in the revenue projection for 15-17.
All right, so the 40% applies to the 264, not to the 4.
That's 60. Yeah, it did not apply to lottery or the beginning balance.
Okay.
Got Rep. Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I missed some of your presentation because of the interesting chanting in the hallway. And Mr. Chair, I really appreciate you, Senate, inviting us here. But this is an aside, but am I to anticipate that if we have demonstrations like this in the future, this is what we can anticipate no matter what the topic? Because in my years in the building, I've not had this happen before where we have something of this importance when it's distracting. And so I'm just wondering if you went outside to try to perhaps move them down the hallway or something so I could better hear what I think is a pretty important presentation.
Representative Benz, I have the same experience. I've never had this. I did talk to the state police. They're on it. I'm not sure what else I can do. I certainly did invite them.
No.
So many possible responses, and I'll just skip all over all of them. So I see that the average appears to be around $200-$300 that people would get back. And I remember in the depths of the recession, the discussion was this get people to spend, and I think we heard that mentioned a few minutes ago by one of the senators. Can you give us an indication of the economic impact of that kicker going back to everybody that gets it?
Yeah, Representative. That's kind of a tricky one. Last time we sent it out, I was a consultant, but I tried to estimate this for Oregon because it was a natural experiment for what came at the U.S. level later as part of the recession package or stimulus package that the Bush administration put in was, if you recall, giving checks out to all our taxpayers in America. So everybody wanted to know, well, what is that going to do? And so, well, we had an experiment from a few months earlier that just so happened that this last kicker check went out just before things, you know, went south here in Oregon, and let's see what happened. And in terms of that, there did seem to be in the employment data a pretty good spike in employment and retail sales stuff. We don't have good retail sales data here. We're not a sales tax state. But we did certainly see an impact in terms of consumer services and retail spending where Oregon's relative performance in those industries did step up. So it did look like this was a stimulus for spending. But then when the whole U.S. Program rolled out and the Bush checks went out, the experience was a little bit different, and people were disappointed by the lack of stimulus out of those checks. And what was explained to at the time was people were having a hard time, and they just used those checks to pay their existing debt and credit cards and didn't go out to the store with them. And so I think it has a lot to do with that environment, the underlying household environment when you get the check. You know, if you've got a lot of outstanding debts and problems and you're at the bottom of a hard times, that translates into less consumer spending than it would, you know, in more normal times.
Follow up, you're done.
No, follow up. The question, of course, is what does this do for an economy, knowing there's no such thing as idle capital and all of that? The question is, what is the benefit, if any, and how can we get a measure of it? And what I'm hearing is very difficult. There's some benefit. I noticed in reviewing the good things that happened when gas prices fell, the economists were saying that was going to result, and the numbers are about the same, oddly enough, of how much a household would save because of lower gas prices. And they were saying there'd be about a 9% increase in Christmas shopping as a result of that, and which was a good thing for the economy. Do we have any such measures for what we're looking at here?
Yeah, Representative Bentz, we don't have an exact measure, but I think it's safe to say that it'll be even at the same numbers as a gas price decrease, that if these are the same level, that we would have less of an impact on the economy of this. Why? Because of the distribution you see here. The issue is when you give a check to a lower income household, they spend all of their current income. When you give money to a higher income household, they save some of it and spend some of it. And so given that the distribution, the kickers, is related to income, and whereas gas consumption is, a bigger part of the budget of a low-income household, there is more of a conduit there. But there is another conduit for good that happens with this kicker that's hard to measure, and you can ask Dr. Warner and his OTIM folks to do it. It would be, what's the benefit of the broader fact that in an average year, personal income taxes, effective rates are down by about 3% because of this. There's never an average year. You either have a big kicker or no kicker. But, over time, you think about, what's my tax burden as a personal income taxpayer in Oregon? The kicker does lower it by about 3%. So whatever the impacts of that are.
Thank you.
Representative Bentz, and I did not mean to be flip with you previously, but the state police have this, that they're not going to write any citations unless we think they're interfering with this. And I told them I think they have crossed that line, so actions are taken, okay?
If I may,
yes.
I'm perfectly happy with demonstrations. I'm just worried that the precedent we're going to have this happening,
yes,
all the time. And frankly, it is distracting.
Yeah.
And I don't want it happening all the time. I get the message, but if you've done all you can do as chair, then
that's
great.
I think actions are being taken now. And
thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up, if I could, on the questions that we were just leading to. I assume that spending that takes place at universities and community colleges and K-12 also have stimulative effects on the economy.
Absolutely, Representative Barnhart. Yes, they absolutely do. It's dollar for dollar, just as with private spending, provided that there is the same kind of efficiency or kind of gains for where you put it. And I think when you're talking about education, everyone would argue there's a big return to investment there. So yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Rep. Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you both for your excellent testimony again. I'd like to go back to slide 24, one back. I think 3 months ago this was called the shrinking kicker slide, but I find it fascinating and confusing at the same time, and I imagine the public does, in light of misunderstanding of the kicker in general. Could you walk through each of the beginning balance kicker, kicker offsets, talk about how we get to that net change number, what the real effect of a $473 million kicker is, what it means that it's spread out over three biennium?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Davis, and I apologize for not doing a better job with this in it before. But the thing about the kicker is, the kicker happens when there's more things, the economy performs better than we expect, and you get in more revenue than we expected to get in because of that, because we had more jobs and more earning and the like. Well, what happens when you have more jobs and more earnings? Well, that improves the revenue outlook for the future and for today. So there are a couple things that happen. For one, we had unexpected revenues come in. Well, that kind of starts us off at a higher point, to the extent that revenue isn't one-time stuff. If it's just one-time investment blip, maybe we don't start at a higher point. But given that this kicker is predominantly determined by more jobs and more labor income, we're starting at a bigger economy or a bigger, labor market in Oregon, which would suggest more resources going forward. So that's the first line, beginning balance. 15 came in better than we thought. We have more jobs, more income taxes, so we're starting at a higher point. So that carries over into the next biennium and offsets some of this negative that we have when we return the refunds. The offsets, we went into some detail. It's a smaller number, but not all the checks go out. And then forecast changes. So not only do we start at a higher jump-off point, but now we've seen all this good news, and it's related into a higher trajectory.
Mr. Chair, if I could. kicker says minus 121, most people think, well, we just set a $473 million kicker. So where do we get to 121?
I'm sorry, Representative Davis. Yeah, the fine print there says change relative to the March 15 forecast.
Thank you.
So, we were debating this because whether we added the general fund forecast changes from both of the forecasts and the lottery changes from both, and then we would have different numbers there than on the other slide. So, yeah, sorry about the confusion there. We'll go ahead and pull together a pre-kicker to post-kicker, a December to now for you numbers to give you the totals as well. But that's it. The beginning balance is a higher jump-off point. The general fund forecast changers are now a higher trajectory. So we got a bunch of good news. So we're starting at a higher point with a higher trajectory. And with this 2.5 years to go, like I said, this really compounds into big numbers, so big that it even it erases what we're kicking out at this size of a kicker. When we're at a kicker of, 3%-ish like we are now, the growth can make it, can make a big difference. When last time we were like a 8-9% kicker at that point, there's nothing that this will do.
Thank you. And just to be clear, the reason it's 120 million less is that the kicker went from about 350 to 470, right? So that's the difference there. So the kicker is larger, and that's what that number reflects. And then it's spread out over a couple biennia because of amended tax returns and late filers and this and that, because it's not a check going out at one given time. Just the flow of how tax returns and audits and amendments work, the impact will be felt over a number of years instead of a one-time check.
Thank you.
Representative Smith-Warner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted I had a quick question about on this slide, and I don't have the number, that talks with the colored bars talking about the differences from the March forecast.
Oh, yes.
One of the things is there it is. You have the difference from the March forecast is that you have corporate revenues down in 2015-17. Could you just talk briefly about? And I didn't – I followed pretty closely in the rest, and I didn't catch that.
That's right. As you see, qualitatively not a big difference here in this outlook. The reduction in corporate collections here has to do with the profit outlook, really. We just changed this forecast for corporate profits, which we take from a national vendor 3,000 miles away. There are certain things that – so driver variables that we don't want to have anything to do with, like the stock market forecast or the profit forecast and the like. So this is just a direct reflection of those changing expectations. But once more, this is really, right now, this is pretty arbitrary, saying that, okay, we've got this processing system that's moving things along a lot faster, and the refunds and payments going out are out of whack compared with historical patterns. So, these year-to-year comparisons right now are tough. So we're expecting some of this to come out over the next few months as this, the system gets mature and we, can do our, it gets back down to whatever trend we're really supposed to be at.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. One of the biggest days of the legislature, the biggest and most significant economic forecast in our cycle. And you guys did a good job, as always. Thank you for your work.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Committee, House members, we will adjourn. We will adjourn.